This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Still searching for a great candidate for your company? Don't search, just match with Indeed. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/the best. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey, TT Book listeners. It's Anne here with a podcast special. This is part of a collaboration with the LA Review of Books, a conversation on the edge, and in this case, the edge of belief. Where all the weird stuff we can't explain lives. Or maybe I should say, hides.
You know, the classic case was somebody would wake up in the middle of the night and they would see grandma or a child at the foot of the bed waving goodbye or dripping wet or something. And they would find out the next day or a couple days later that grandma or the child had died or drowned at more or less exactly that time.
This is Jeff Kripal, a highly original, even maverick, historian of religion, and a guy who is building a connection between the mystical and the paranormal. Kripal mines the backwaters and undercurrents of religion. He collects stories of precognitive dreams, near-death experiences, and alien abductions, the kind of experiences most people would not even consider calling religious. But then his view of Christianity is on the unorthodox side. He talks about the homoerotic and very queer roots of Catholicism. This from a guy who once studied to be a monk. His interest in the erotic origins of religion launched, and later scuttled, his academic career as a scholar of Hindu mysticism. And then he discovered the Esalen Institute, ground zero for the human potential movement and a launching pad for people who like to question the scientific paradigm for how we understand spiritual experiences. So Kripal has a new book out. It's called Secret Body, and it weaves together these various strands of his work, partly a memoir, it's also a subversive reinterpretation of religion, all of which made Steve Paulson intensely curious.
Jeff, at the very beginning of your book, you say the unvarnished truth is that things have been very trippy. And I have to say, that is the kind of thing I might expect to hear from someone who's taken a lot of hallucinogens, but not from a scholar of religion. Is that a comment about your own life, or do you think of religion itself as trippy?
Well, religion is trippy. I mean, the only reason we think it's not trippy is because we've grown too accustomed to our own religious worldview. I mean, all we have to do is step out of that worldview and look at another religion, and it looks like a psychedelic trip.
That is not my image of religion. I mean, you know, most discussions I see about religion seem rather stodgy, or thinking about going to, say, a Christian church service. There's rarely anything trippy at all about that. What am I missing?
Well, nothing. That's fair. That's perfectly accurate. But I don't study religion in that sense. I'm not even interested in religion in that sense. That's sort of religion way, way down the road after it's been established and become part of a society or an ideology. I'm interested in the sort of sources, the kind of experiential sources of religion.
You're talking about what people actually experience that then later turns into a codified sense of religion.
That's correct. I'm sort of interested in religion before it becomes religion. These anomalous events or extreme experiences that form the basis of various religious ideas like the existence of a soul or the immortality of the soul.
So give me one or two examples of that. What kinds of extreme experiences attract you?
So, for example, I just finished a book with a woman here in Houston named Elizabeth Crone. And in 1988, she was attending the first anniversary of her grandfather's death at her synagogue. And she stepped out of the car with her two-year-old boy and was immediately struck by lightning. And what followed was this incredibly elaborate near-death experience in a kind of paradisiacal garden that completely changed her and convinced her that the soul is real and immortal. And when she came back and was healing from all of the lightning burns, she began to have all kinds of dreams of plane crashes and earthquakes that would then play out in the next day news. So that's what I mean. Now, those experiences did not fit in to her religious upbringing, but led her to a series of beliefs and convictions that could be located somewhere in the tradition, but in places of which she simply wasn't aware beforehand.
And there was something, there's something really weird about what you're just saying. You're saying that she had precognitive dreams? I mean, she dreamed about stuff that became true?
Yeah, that showed up on the news the next day. And she eventually learned to send herself time-stamped emails immediately after the nightmare so that she had some proof that she actually dreamed it. So we have those emails, and then we have the events, and you can line them up. And that's only the beginning, Steve. I mean, my experience over and over working with people like Elizabeth is that the first or second or even third story you hear are the easy ones. And if you keep hearing stories, they get weirder, and then they get weirder, and then they get weirder. They never finally make sense. And that was the case with Elizabeth. I mean, I could tell you stories of a haunted necklace, of plants that die when their owners die, reading minds, that sort of thing.
You're talking about what we would call paranormal experiences.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's not usually what we think about as religion. I think we tend to sort of put that in an entirely different category.
Well, that's a mistake. You know, the word paranormal is a very new word. Was coined in 1903 by a French scientist. And it's a way, or it's an attempt to secularize and make natural experiences that had always before that had a religious framework. And these experiences happen every day to thousands of people. They're as common as water. But we live in a culture that suppresses them in various explicit and implicit ways. And so people don't talk about them. Elizabeth waited 30 years to come out of her closet to talk about these experiences because she was afraid of what her social peers would think, and she was afraid her children would be made fun of at school. So she waited till they were grown up, and she simply doesn't care anymore. She's ready to tell her story.
Again, coming back to traditional notions of religion, I mean, that's usually talk about God or, you know, the Bible or sacred scriptures or that kind of thing. That's not what you're talking about here.
No, I think things like God and scripture and tradition are later developments of these same sorts of experiences that then get remembered in a community and they develop into ideas. So, for example, if you had, say, 100 or 200 people like Elizabeth who had a similar kind of near-death experience, you would have stories floating around in the community about how the soul survives bodily death. And we have these capacities to receive information from the future. And then you would develop beliefs like the soul, prophecy, divination, that sort of thing. And of course, that's exactly what you see in the history of religions. And so my position is that these beliefs are not crazy, superstitious things that silly people make up. These beliefs are the direct outcome of actual experiences. And it doesn't mean that the experiences are metaphysically or ontologically true. That I can't tell. But it does mean people have these experiences. And that's essentially what I study.
So how far back does this idea of religion go for you? I mean, does this go all the way back to your childhood?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I grew up in Nebraska in a farming community. I wasn't particularly religious as a boy. You know, I grew up Roman Catholic, just sort of assuming a lot of things like this. But when I hit puberty, I became super, super pious and ended up in a monastic seminary wanting to be a monk.
Hmm. So you thought you were going to be a monk for the rest of your life?
Yeah, I did.
How long did you last in the monastic seminary?
4 years. Yeah, it was a seminary. I never joined the monastery. And at the end of the day, my monastic mentors thought, and I agreed with them, that I didn't actually have a religious vocation. I had an intellectual vocation, and that I needed to go to graduate school and not enter the monastery. So that's what I did.
And but there were, I mean, you've also written about some of the cultural aspects of being in that seminary that didn't fit. I mean, you said that pretty much all the other guys in the seminary were gay, and you weren't.
Right. It was definitely a gay community. And by that, I mean most of the young men were closeted gay men who had turned to the priesthood or the religious life as a way of positively and creatively sublimating that into some kind of spiritual life. And I wasn't gay. I was highly repressed, but I was ultimately straight, and I just didn't fit in.
So was that just kind of a sort of weird quirk of this particular seminary that you were in, or does this say something deeper about the nature of religion?
Well, the argument I make in Secret Body is that this kind of male homoeroticism is orthodox in the history of Christianity, because God is always male. And if you are going to be in love with God or marry Jesus, to use the Catholic language, a male homoerotic orientation works very well. And if you happen to be a straight man, it actually makes no sense. It's an impossible emotional and spiritual orientation to think yourself into.
Wait, you'll have to explain this. What makes Christianity, what makes homoeroticism sort of this bedrock within Christian history?
Well, you know, in terms of Roman Catholicism now, the institution is controlled by males who are celibate, so who are not married to women. Many of them are living in all-male or same-sex communities, and they're promoting the love and worship of a kind of alpha male in the sky, i.e. God or Jesus. So they're not worshiping a woman. They're not eating the body and drinking the blood of a woman. They're eating the body and drinking the blood of a divine male. And so that privileges or selects for men who have what today we would call, you know, gay genders or gay spiritualities.
What does that say about the life of Jesus? I mean, how should we read that life? I mean, are you saying there's something homoerotic there?
Yes. I think there's a lot of scholarship on both Jesus and Paul, neither of whom were married. Jesus had a beloved disciple who was another man. Paul wanted all his followers, both male and female, to be virgins and to marry Christ, which is a very queer homoerotic notion for men. I think the origins of Christianity lie in this kind of sexual spiritual orientation that could not be fit in to the heterosexual structures of society. And that's also why Jesus preached against the family and, you know, asked his disciples to essentially leave their families.
Wow. Are you suggesting that Jesus was gay?
So I think that's an anachronistic question. I think the safest thing to say is that he was anything but straight. He wasn't a heterosexual male married to a woman with 2.5 kids and a golden retriever living in the suburbs.
You do like throwing bombshells, don't you?
But see, Steve, lots of people have said this. There's a whole body of scholarship on this. I'm just speaking about it because it helps explain my own experience in the seminary and my own experience with Christianity.
So you said that the seminary was not the right place for you, went off to graduate school, ended up studying Asian mystical traditions. Why was that so appealing to you?
Well, because I became convinced that there were no heterosexual mystical models in Catholicism or Christianity. There were only male models of divinity and no feminine ones. Hinduism fascinated me because there were all of these female deities with whom human males erotically unite or spiritually unite. And so I was really interested in Hinduism in particular because it seemed to offer heterosexual mystical traditions for men. That's really what drew me to it.
Hmm. And you've written about a profound transformative experience you had in Calcutta in 1989. When you say that you became Shiva, can you describe that experience?
Well, you have to know something about the iconography. So what I was actually studying was a tradition called Shakta Tantra. The iconography is a black or blue erotic goddess standing on her husband, Shiva, who is lying prostrate and is imagined as asleep or as in meditation or as dead. And she's often described as erotically engaging him. And during Kali Puja, which was this festival dedicated to this particular goddess, I had just been around the city visiting all the temples and kind of was embedded in this ritual display. And I went to bed and I woke up early in the morning and I couldn't move. I was paralyzed. I was lying on my back exactly like Shiva in this iconography. And this astonishing energy, erotic energy entered the room or came out of me or came out of something and started to engage my body. And I was entirely conscious. I was perfectly awake, but again, I was paralyzed. My first assumption was that there was an electrical dysfunction in the wall and that I was being electrocuted. That's how strong it was. And then I thought I was having a heart attack and I was dying. And when both of those didn't happen, I sort of surrendered to it, and it sort of imploded into my chest region. And at that point, I had the sensation of leaving my body and floating up to the ceiling in a kind of classic out-of-body experience or near-death experience. And when I eventually got back into my body and could move my fingers and my feet again, I felt as if this tremendous download had been transmitted into my body and my mind. And I couldn't have told you what it was about. I had no idea. I just had this sense that something profound had happened. And so when I wrote my dissertation, which became my first book, it was really very much about trying to put this energy, or this Shakti, as the tradition calls it, onto the page and get it out, as it were, because I thought that's what it wanted.
You've had a lot of years to think about this, and have you figured out what happened? I mean, can you explain this?
No, I can't. So early on in the 90s, I thought my job was to get to some interpretation of this event. Like, there was some correct interpretation. But since then, I've abandoned that. I don't believe that, actually. I think the event was infinitely meaningful, and that every book I've written so far has been an attempt to express it, and that that was the point of the experience. In other words, all of the later books and all of the later work.
But clearly you don't think this was just sort of, you know, you had an overactive imagination. I mean, it sounds like you're saying that you encountered some kind of transcendent dimension of reality.
Or of myself. I mean, I was electrocuted by some presence. And that electrocution was intelligent and had information in it. And I've spent the rest of my life trying to express that. I totally believe that, Steve. I don't know how else to describe it. I'm not believing anything. I'm not a fan of belief, actually. I think belief shuts us down and gives us easy answers. I'm simply describing what happened to you and how I've spent my life trying to make sense of it.
I'm talking with Jeff Kripal, a professor of religion at Rice University and the author of Secret Body, Erotic and Esoteric Currents in the History of Religions. So you spent years studying Asian, specifically Hindu mystical traditions. That ended up becoming a very fraught subject for you. The Hindu nationalist didn't like what you were doing. You ended up going in a different direction. And at a certain point, you discovered the Esalen Institute, that gathering place for alternative spirituality in Big Sur. How did that happen?
What happened was from about 1997 on, as the internet was getting going, I was being harassed and targeted by Hindu nationalists and fundamentalists who hated my first book, Kali's Child, which was largely about these ideas we've been talking about. And I was just a young professor without tenure. It was really just my dissertation, which had become a book. I was all of 30 years old, 35 years old at that point, maybe. And it was scary, and it was bad, and it went on for years and years and years.
I mean, you were targeted with death threats and all kinds of crazy stuff, right?
Well, I actually never received a death threat, but I received a lot of quasi-threatening email, and there was a lot of horrible things written about me in the Indian newspapers and by major politicians. So it was scary. And I eventually concluded that I had to leave the field. I had spent 15 years at that point studying this culture I loved and these languages I loved. And it took me years to start to let go of that. It was a death process, really. And right in the middle of that, in the early summer of 1998, Michael Murphy called me late one night. He had just finished the same book, Kali's Child, and was extremely enthused by it.
Michael Murphy, the co-founder of the Esalen Institute.
Right. And he invited me out there. So I did that. And then I went back in 99 and again in 2000. And somewhere around there, it occurred to me that if I left the study of Hinduism, I could write a history of Esalen and become an Americanist and kind of survive intellectually and professionally and still use a lot of my training.
Now, there is a popular stereotype of Esalen that is not so positive, which I'm sure you've heard a lot over the years. In fact, Kurt Anderson just wrote about Esalen in his book Fantasy Land. As he talked about Esalen as a kind of cautionary tale, and he says basically everything that became known as New Age was invented, developed, or popularized at the Esalen Institute. And he goes on to say that Esalen was driven by a suspicion of science and reason, and an embrace of magical thinking, and also massage, hot tubs, sex, and sex in hot tubs. What do you make of that kind of response?
I think it's kind of silly. I mean, you can find whatever you're looking for, of course, at a place like Esalen that's been around for over 50 years, and you can certainly find the sex, and there's certainly hot tubs there, but they don't fit into these kind of grotesque stereotypes that Anderson's promoting there. Also, I've worked with hundreds of scientists now, many of them world-class, and I've met them all at Esalen. So it's simply not true. There's a real intellectual thread or river that runs through Esalen, and it's filled with very, very serious people with PhDs, basically, in, you know, everything from neuroscience to cosmology to quantum physics. These are very, very serious people. So those kinds of stereotypes are simply ignorant.
Now, you say in your book that one of the most influential intellectual presences in Esalen's early history was Aldous Huxley, the novelist who wrote that famous book about psychedelics, The Doors of Perception. Why was he so important?
Because he was writing about something he called human potentialities. He was very learned in the world's mystical traditions, and he himself had had some profound mystical experiences on mescaline, which he wrote about in The Doors of Perception. And so he was essentially one of the intellectual keys to the founding of Esalen, which eventually coined this phrase, the human potential movement, in the mid-1960s, which was, you know, right out of Aldous Huxley.
And there's a big idea here that I think Huxley talked about, that the mind exists independently of the brain, which goes totally against the scientific paradigm that we have, and which sees, you know, the mind as maybe an emergent property of the brain or the manifestation of all those billions of neurons and synaptic connections that are firing. This is really a different way of thinking about the brain and the mind, right?
Right. So Huxley articulated what he called mind at large in The Doors of Perception in 1954. And basically what he argued was, he says, you know, the naive idea is that when you take something like mescaline, you have this trippy experience that's produced by these molecules messing with your synapses, essentially, or your brain. And he said, this is not what my experience was at all. It was more like that the mescaline shut down my brain, shut down my cognitive processes, and these other forms of mind, which were always already there, then rushed in, and I could perceive reality as it really is, and not as my brain was filtering it through language and categories before. He argued that essentially that mind at large, or what we might call consciousness with a capital C, is distributed throughout the natural world, throughout the universe, and that the brain is a highly evolved biological filter or translator of this cosmic mind that turns it into essentially a person.
So you're saying that the brain in this framework, this model, the brain detects this consciousness, sort of, you know, takes it in and allows us to experience it, but it doesn't actually generate consciousness.
Correct. So in this model, you know, when the brain dies or the person dies, the person probably does go away because the person and the ego are connected to the body and the brain, but consciousness itself is completely unaffected. Just like when you take your cell phone or smartphone and throw it against the wall, that's not going to harm the Wi-Fi signal. You've just made it impossible to receive it and to turn it into Steve Paulson's personal smartphone, but you've done nothing to the Wi-Fi signal.
So to me, this debate over materialism is one of the great fault lines in our intellectual life. I mean, it's really the big question about religion and transcendent experience. It shapes how we interpret all kinds of really powerful experiences, you know, like near-death experiences, psychedelics, the paranormal. It's fundamental in terms of how we talk about the nature of consciousness, you know, whether the mind is just what the brain does, as the neuroscientists say, or whether it's something else. What do you think is at stake here?
Well, everything. I think everything hinges on what we think mind or consciousness is. And if we think it's just the brain doing what the brain does, then it's pretty damn depressing. And we live in a bleak world in which all meaning and all life cease when we cease. But if we live in a different world where everything is somehow embedded in consciousness, and that we're transmitters or receivers of this broader cosmic life, then suddenly the universe is a marvelous place, and we live in a kind of ecstatic, naturally ecstatic world. I'm not arguing that everything about mental life is transcendent. I think it's quite likely that cognition and sensory perception and all sorts of things are entirely brain-dependent. I'm talking about consciousness as consciousness. I'm not talking about our egos or a particular sense perception or a particular emotion.
Well, let's talk about the paranormal, this subject that fascinates you, fascinates me as well. Do we have to try to figure out whether these psychic experiences, you know, whether someone talks about seeing a ghost or having a precognitive experience, whether those are literally true, or what do we do with those?
I think the first thing we do is we recognize that they happen. I think the conversation gets shut down by the debunkers who want to say they never happen or that they're always fraudulent, which clearly is not the case. It's simply false. Once we get over that first hurdle and we acknowledge that they happen, then we can begin to play with models in which they're possible or impossible. And I think what they do for us that's so productive is that they help us realize that what we consider impossible is simply a function of our present models of the natural world. And so what paranormal phenomena do is they push us to develop new models of the natural world and new models of ourselves. And so they're productive, they're creative, they're intellectually stimulating. And that's why I find them so fascinating.
Will you tell one story about Mark Twain? He had this dream that his brother died. Can you describe what happened?
Right. I mean, this is one of millions of these, but essentially what happened to Twain is he went to bed and he had this very, very realistic dream of his brother dying and him visiting the body at a wake in which he was in a metal casket and in a particular suit. And there was a bouquet sitting on his chest. I think it was white flowers with a single red rose in the middle, or vice versa, I forget. And the dream was so realistic, when he got up, he got dressed to go down to the funeral home, because this was just totally real to him, until he realized it was a dream. Well, a couple weeks later, his brother was in fact killed in a boiler accident on a steamboat. And when Twain visited his brother's body, he saw exactly what he had seen in the dream. He saw him in a metal casket in the exact suit he was in. The only thing that was missing was the bouquet. And as he was sitting there, kind of stunned by the fact that he'd already seen all this, a woman walked in and laid that exact bouquet on his brother's chest. So that's kind of a classic case, but it's not unusual.
Well, it almost sounds like you're saying these stories of the paranormal are, they're kind of narratives in themselves. I mean, we almost need a new narrative to account for this. I mean, we're entering the mythic realm here.
Right. So the way I got into the paranormal was I was sitting around symposia at Esalen with a bunch of physicists and neuroscientists, these scientists that aren't supposed to exist at Esalen. And I was listening to them talk about paranormal phenomena, always as objective events that could be measured, and there was some kind of causal chain that they wanted to find. And I grew skeptical of all of that, and I kept pointing out that actually paranormal stories are always stories. They always have a beginning, middle, and an end, and they seem to be aimed toward the production of meaning or comfort or guidance in a person's life. And they're much more fruitfully approached as narratives, as stories. And that, again, is why I do not think science is our best approach here. Science is great at math and mechanism, but it's horrible at meaning.
But I mean, but there is the question of, did it really happen? Is this real? Isn't that sort of a foundational question about a lot of these stories?
It's not a question in my mind. Of course they happen. I mean, I've witnessed them happening. I see no reason why people would be lying about this. I mean, I know there are frauds and I know there are hoaxes, but I've just seen too much and I've read too much. It's just not even a question for me. And I'm not interested in it, Steve. I'm not interested in having that debate because I think it just freezes the conversation again.
And one of the things that's striking about a lot of these stories, like Mark Twain's, is some trauma seems to trigger this. In other words, these might be once-in-a-lifetime stories, but it's often when something cataclysmic either has happened or maybe is about to happen.
That's correct. They're largely about suffering and illness and death and danger and love. They usually spark between loved ones, where one of the loved ones is in mortal danger or is dying. And that's why, again, you can't shove them into a laboratory because we can't kill people or threaten to kill people.
So they're kind of hard to reproduce in a lab.
They're impossible to reproduce, at least the robust ones. You can kind of get minor statistical significance in a lab for sure, but you can't produce these really robust drop-your-jaw cases.
I have to say, it is so fun talking with you. And the other thing that I find astonishing is, I mean, you are at a highly regarded university, Rice University, and you are saying stuff that is really out there. Do you get much pushback?
So I get asked that a lot. Okay, there's a double answer. The first answer is that there's a totem pole in the academy, and physics is on the very top, and the study of religion's on the very bottom. And the higher you go on that totem pole, the less likely you are going to say these outrageous things because you need to protect your privilege and your authority. The lower you are on that totem pole, the less you have to lose. And since I'm on the bottom of the totem pole, I have almost nothing to lose, and I can say whatever the hell I want because I don't know anything. You know,
but what happens when you get together with other religion scholars? Are they kind of, you know, snickering behind your back? You know,
okay.
that Jeff Kripal has a few screws loose.
Okay, so you'd have to ask them, Steve. But well, I actually know a lot of them are in the closet on this one. I go to a lot of universities and I give lectures on this material, and almost always afterwards, a colleague or a group of colleagues will come up and say, "You know, you're right about that," or "I had this experience. Can I tell you about it?" Or, "Wow, I'm really glad you're saying that." But they're not going to say it. You know, they're not going to stick their necks out. So I think there's a lot of intellectuals are in the closet on these things, but they're fascinated by them, and they actually appreciate someone like myself trying to make sense out of them.
And your whole reinterpretation of religion is so fascinating because, as far as I can tell, you don't sort of fall into any of the usual narratives. I mean, certainly not what atheists say about religion, but also not what you hear from Christian theologians who are arguing for the historical truth of the resurrection. And it's also not the kind of, you know, cultural or sociological analysis of so many contemporary scholars in religious studies. And it sort of raises the question of how should we talk about religion?
Well, see, that is my job. My job is to forge a new way of talking about religion that neither falls into the category of belief or the category of dismissal. I'm really trying to push into a third space where we can take religious experience very, very seriously, but not fall into some traditional answer or some traditional non-answer. So that's what I do. I mean, that's who I am. I'm a historian of religions. That's my job. And if you find it fascinating, then I'm doing my job. I mean, that's a good thing.
Should we read the story of the resurrection of Jesus as a ghost story?
So there's a New Testament critic named Dale Allison at Princeton Seminary who's written a beautiful essay called Resurrecting Jesus. And what he essentially does in this is he takes the resurrection encounters in the Gospels and he compares them to encounters widows and loved ones have with dead loved ones in the 20th century that are available in the parapsychological literature. And they're remarkably close. People encounter dead loved ones in physical form in the modern world. It's not that unusual. And these are very comforting and very powerful experiences. What I take from that is that the resurrection appearances were probably real. They probably happened, but they're not unique. They happen all the time. So that kind of method or that kind of approach makes something like Christianity more real and plausible, but it also challenges the tradition's claim to uniqueness or exclusive truth.
Right. And it also challenges the whole notion that religion's even supposed to venture into these other realms of, you know, of psychic phenomena. I mean, that religion usually scorns that or is terrified of it, I think.
Well, I think they're terrified because if you get very far into it, you realize they're universal and they're not exclusive to any particular religious tradition. And so you have to give up your illusions of being special and you have to acknowledge that all human beings have these capacities or these potentials.
That's Jeff Kripal talking with Steve Paulson. Jeff is a professor of religion at Rice University, and he's the author of Secret Body. The LA Review of Books is publishing a longer version of this conversation. If you're interested in UFOs, definitely check that one out. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and if conversations with scholars and writers and cultural critics are your thing, you should be a regular listener. You will find To the Best of Our Knowledge on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you find your favorite podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're based in Madison, Wisconsin, and distributed by PRX.